National Train Day returns on Saturday. Amtrak, the National Railroad Passenger Corporation, started the event a few years ago to bring people out to railroad stations and get them thinking about traveling by train. Events are planned at the train stations in Dunsmuir, Klamath Falls, and Eugene, among others. We're always happy to talk about trains on the exchange, and this certainly gives us a perfect opportunity. Our guest this time around is Arthur Poole, who just left his position as Vice President of Mission Accomplishment at NARP, the National Association of Railroad Passengers. While NARP is based in Washington, close to Congress and Amtrak headquarters, Art Poole lives in Coos Bay. He's a founding member of AORTA, the Association of Oregon Rail and Transit Advocates, and active in a number of transportation-related organizations. Arthur Poole, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
You're very welcome, Jeff.
Did you ever work for a railroad yourself, or is it just in the family's blood?
No, I never have worked for a railroad, but I'm involved with a lot of associations that have connections, you know, with the railroads, because our Amtrak system, for the most part, operates on the private network of rail lines across the country. So I do sit at the table. For example, I'm on the Oregon Rail Users League, and the Class 1 railroads, the big railroads like Union Pacific, BNSF Railway, and also the regional railroads and short line railroads also participate in that. It's a organization that helps to shepherd the Connect Oregon program that helps to fund non-highway projects in the state of Oregon.
Which brings up one of the major issues, I would think, for passenger trains in this country. When you talk about the amount of tax money that goes to Amtrak and other railroad projects versus what goes to highways, is there still a great disparity in how that money is doled out?
Yeah, there is a big disparity. In the case of Amtrak, it's pretty much funded by Congress, and those of us who want passenger trains have to essentially beg Congress for funding on a periodic basis. But we're coming to a crisis with all forms of transportation, so perhaps there's an opportunity for some change. For example, the Highway Trust Fund is near bankruptcy. That funds highways and transit, important modes of transportation, but it's funded primarily by the gas tax, which in Oregon hasn't been changed since 1993, and it's a fixed cents per gallon. It's not a percentage of your fuel tax, so it's not keeping up with the cost of repairing and improving our highways, and plus motor vehicles are becoming more energy efficient. In aviation, the control network for our flights to make them safe is a public enterprise, and that needs to be updated. The technology needs to be updated, which is going to cost billions of dollars, and in round numbers, about $40 billion to upgrade it, and the airline companies themselves are going to probably put in $7 billion. The rest of that will be a taxpayer expense. So all forms of transportation are subsidized. But what NARP would hope is that rail would be included in a transportation trust fund or a multimodal transportation fund, so that we can all get behind transportation improvements and not fight one mode versus another, but let each mode perform to its best efficiencies and technological capabilities.
Art, would you give us a bit of history on NARP and its formation and goals?
Yes. NARP was formed in 1967 at the end of the passenger train era, and its founder was Anthony Haswell, Tony Haswell, who was a Chicago attorney at the time, a native of Ohio, who, with a small group, organized the National Association of Railroad Passengers. In 1967 was also a critical point in passenger rail history, because it was during that year that the post office stopped subsidizing or using the railroads for the delivery of mail for the most part. And that was helping to keep passenger trains profitable for the private railroads. And when that ended, that mail service era ended, then it was no longer profitable for the private carriers to operate the service. So people like Tony Haswell felt that, gee, we could lose all passenger rail service in this country. And so NARP was formed to try to save the passenger train. And it was instrumental in developing what is now Amtrak, which took over from the private railroads the operation of intercity passenger trains in 1971.
Right, just 4 years after the formation of NARP. So we'll talk about that timeline a little bit more and about the issues that were facing passenger trains as they looked very close to grinding to a halt across America in the late 60s, and the formation of Amtrak. Arthur Poole, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a member of the National Association of Railroad Passengers, and an Oregon resident as well. We'll come back and talk more with Art about passenger trains, past, present, and future, and you can join this discussion on the Exchange when we come back in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about passenger trains in America. Amtrak's National Train Day is this coming Saturday. If you head to the depot late morning, early afternoon in Klamath Falls, Dunsmuir, or Eugene, you'll find events going on there for all members of the family. It gives us an opportunity to talk about passenger trains in America, past, present, and future. And our guest to talk about that is Arthur Poole, a member of the National Association of Railroad Passengers, or NARP, which formed in 1967. And you can join this discussion on the Exchange about passenger trains, what your thoughts are about where they should be going, how fast they should go, how frequently they should arrive. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. Curious about the title you just relinquished at NARP, the Vice President of Mission Accomplishment. That's a great title. What were you doing in that role?
Well, I was primarily working with my colleagues across the country to, you know, better communicate grassroots efforts to work on passenger train development. We have a plan at NARP to have a network of passenger trains that is, we feel, realistic. It goes where there are currently rail lines, the vice chair for mission accomplishment works with, we have the country divided up into divisions, and I work with division leaders across the country to work on problems. An example of one away from the area we're talking about today here in the state of Jefferson, so to speak, would be the Hoosier State, a train that operates between Chicago and Indianapolis. When the intercity train between Chicago and the East Coast, the Cardinal, is not operating, and a law passed by Congress in 2007 requires states to pick up the tab on lines that operate for 750 miles or less. And so we had to rally folks in Indiana to get their state to support that train, and we had a tremendous groundswell of support, especially from students at Purdue University, because the train goes through West Lafayette, and the governor of the state came around, and that was the last state to support a state-supported train. Here in the Northwest, Oregon and Washington have cooperated quite closely on funding the Cascade service between Eugene and Vancouver, British Columbia. And it's important to have, you know, all of these people playing at the federal, state, and local level.
Which is a very different set of funding models from what existed at the time that NARP started and what existed before Amtrak. NARP started in 1967, Amtrak in 1971. Prior to Amtrak, the independent railroads ran their own passenger trains, and they didn't want to run them anymore because they were losing money on them. As you pointed out, the mail right. service contracts came off in 67. Amtrak comes along in 71, so there's national funding for railroads, national coordination for passenger trains, but still running on the freight railroads. And then there was the, this was the 403B provision, wasn't it called that at one time?
That's right, yeah, to provide service that maybe some states would be interested in, yeah.
And so that's been the case since the beginning where the states have ponied up a little bit to get some additional stops or an additional route?
Right, and there were some experimental routes that were started during that period. But, you know, the laws have changed over the years, the Amtrak authorization laws, so, you know, that no longer applies, that mechanism, and we've lost a lot of services that were begun on a experimental or trial basis, and we feel, as passenger advocates, that those lines could be just as efficient as the existing 15 long-distance routes that remain, but one of the big problems is we don't have enough equipment to operate those lines or to bring them back at the present time. But there's certainly the need there because a lot of people, can't use the airways for travel. They've got medical conditions, for example, that don't allow them to fly. And some people have, you know, other reasons for not flying. So it's important to have mobility for Americans on the ground. And for long distances, trains are more comfortable for most people than inner-city bus, for example.
You know, this brings up the point that Oregon actually lost a passenger train not terribly long ago when Amtrak ceased to run the Pioneer, which was a Seattle, Portland, Pendleton, Boise, Salt Lake City, Denver, all the way to Chicago train. And what was the dynamic there? What caused that that train to be lost?
Well, I think primarily it was a lack of equipment. The train was operating not initially with superliner equipment, but eventually with bi-level superliner cars. And as trains went out of service due to wrecks or mechanical problems, they didn't have enough equipment to operate on a daily basis, and plus I think Amtrak wanted to reposition some of that equipment. Some of that superliner equipment, for example, today operates on Amtrak's successful auto train on the East Coast, and Amtrak brought in a consultant to look at their network and a company called Mercer, and they came up with a plan to become more efficient. I won't say profitable because profitability is not really a possibility, but efficiency is a realistic goal. And they thought that Amtrak could improve itself by reducing its service. And that's not the way to achieve success. It's been proven that actually ridership went down when they did that. And I rode the Pioneer in my work as an agricultural extension agent. I worked on establishing weather stations and working with them in the farm enterprises I worked with, and I dealt with the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation in Boise, and I took the Pioneer several times to Boise for meetings with the officials there, and the Pioneer was always well patronized when I rode it, and it's a very important train for the Intermountain West, and places like Boise have grown tremendously since that train came off in 1997. So that not only that train, but the Desert Wind between Salt Lake City and Los Angeles, a lot of folks living in Colorado, rode that train to Southern California. And so those are important links that NARP would like to see brought back.
When you describe the situation with the Pioneer, though, where the equipment just wasn't available because much of it had been taken out of service, it implies certainly a deferred maintenance situation that existed with Amtrak then. Don't know if it still does now. But there is a sense, I think, that Amtrak has been running a shoestring through its almost 45-year existence. Is that a fair assessment of it?
Yeah, that is. It's kind of limped along with limited funding. I think it has a high priority for safety, so the equipment is very well maintained, and it does operate on a proper cycle of maintenance. And Amtrak does have improved maintenance facilities at major terminals such as Los Angeles and Seattle to maintain the equipment. But we really need new cars, and we need a system to sustain manufacturing these cars. Right now, Amtrak does have an order for 130 single-level cars that will be very helpful for its routes, primarily in the East. Those are being manufactured by a Spanish company, but in America at Elmira Heights, New York, and they're starting to come off the assembly line right now. Some of those cars will see service in the West because part of that order includes baggage cars, which are the baggage cars on trains like the Coast Starlight date to the 1950s and are in desperate need of replacement.
And just to clear the subject on the single-level coaches and other cars in the East Coast, I mean, I remember when the Amfleet cars first came on around 1975, so those things are almost 40 years old, and they're just now talking about replacing them. So, they do spend a long time on the rails. We're talking to Arthur Poole, who's a member of the National Association of Railroad Passengers, about passenger trains. National Train Day, an Amtrak event, is coming up on Saturday with events at the train stations in Eugene, Klamath Falls, and Dunsmuir, among others. Here's your chance to talk about passenger trains and what you've experienced aboard them in the country and what you'd like to see happen to passenger trains in America. 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Here's Ryan in Eugene. Welcome to The Exchange with Art Poole.
Well, hi, Jeffrey. It's been
hi.
A while.
Sure has.
It was a great conversation. I'm just fascinated by trains, as I think lots of people are. But I also just happened to ride the Coast Starlight down to the Bay Area last weekend. And it was a great trip, although somewhat misnamed train. But anyway, the one thing that I was amazed by, and I guess I just hadn't been tracking, is how much additional transportation Amtrak is providing. I was amazed looking through the schedule at all of the bus and other interconnections throughout all of Oregon. And so I think, you know, that's one of the pieces that maybe hasn't been shared as well, but it's become much more than just trains.
Ryan brings up a good point.
All right, thanks for that, Ryan. Go ahead.
Ryan brings up a good point, and what he's really getting at is connectivity. And in the early days of Amtrak, there was very little information about connections to not only other trains, but other buses that will bring you closer to your destination. California pioneered that type of service with its Thruway network, but Oregon is continuing that, and for example, where I live, one can get from Eugene to Coos Bay by a Thruway bus under contract with a private, actually family-run bus company. Unfortunately, that company stops service on Saturdays, so it's not 7 days a week. So you really have to study your schedules carefully to find your connections. And another example of that is I often had meetings in Wisconsin and would have to get to the University of Wisconsin in Madison where there isn't direct train service, so I would have to get from the Empire Builder route, which runs somewhat north of Madison, and to get there. And there is a bus line from Milwaukee to Madison that runs frequent service, but they don't cooperate with Amtrak by allowing Amtrak to publish their schedules in there. So it's something that the passenger has to kind of discover on his or her own. And so it makes, you know, public travel by public transportation somewhat challenging.
But California in particular has done a lot to put, we talked about the money that the states put in, and California has funded enough money so that there are corridors now that didn't used to exist. I mean, there were multiple trains between Los Angeles and San Diego before California put money in, but a lot more now. That corridor now goes north from Los Angeles to San Luis Obispo, and there's also the Capital Corridor, which is San Jose to Sacramento generally, but also further beyond.
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's important. And what you're bringing up is the concept of frequency. Passenger trains don't have to be true high speed, which is looking at something that runs at 220 miles per hour. But if they can be competitive with the automobile and run at a frequency that gives riders a choice of when they can travel, then they can be very successful. The Capital Corridor is a good example of that, and the Surfliner Corridor between San Luis Obispo and San Diego is another great example. Those trains are very well patronized and are very successful.
Here's an email from Jackie in Medford. She writes, I took Amtrak from Colorado out to California a few years ago and enjoyed it very much. The train arrived 12 hours late, and I'm told that it's often much worse. Clearly, you have to be retired or otherwise really flexible to put up with that. The fact that people do shows you how much demand for train travel there could be if it were done right. Train travel is wonderful, and I hope to do more. Again, that from Jackie in Medford. I bet you hear that a lot, Art.
I do, and I recall when she experienced that problem on the what they call the California Zephyr route, because I had a meeting in Chicago and was going to take the train from Eugene down to Sacramento, take the Zephyr east, and the Union Pacific was doing track work on that line, and the Amtrak trains were so out of phase with their crews, hours of service, all of that, that the train I was to take was canceled. I had to reroute myself on the Empire Builder to get to my destination. That route, I think, is much improved since Jackie rode it, but another route, the Empire Builder route that runs up through North Dakota, has had tremendous problems, and trains have been 12 hours and more late, and to the point where Amtrak has had to temporarily adjust the schedule to try to make it more useful for the traveling public, because it's a very popular train, and the big factor there is congestion with all of the oil train traffic in the Bakken Shale oil fields near Williston, North Dakota.
Oh, sure, another effect of the oil trains. And, of course, this is a freight railroad, and so they want to get the freight out. And do they, I mean, there are contracts, aren't there, that penalize the freight railroad for making a train late on Amtrak?
That's true. Private railroads are supposed to give priority to Amtrak, but in the case of that route, BNSF Railway has generally been very good at working with Amtrak, but they really had more business than they could efficiently handle, so even their own trains were not running efficiently, and other customers, freight customers, were not being well served in that area. That's being addressed. The company is going to increase the capacity of that line. They're going to double track more of the line, but that takes time. They are investing tremendous amounts of money, but you have to work within work seasons, generally the summertime, and that's a very harsh winter climate. So it's probably going to take several years to get that totally improved. But that's part of the problem we have in trying to operate passenger trains. There is a section of the passenger rail law now in effect that started in 2008 that goes under the acronym PREA that call for Amtrak and the Federal Railroad Administration to look at the metrics and quality of service. And the freight railroads fought that successfully, and a federal court ruled that they defined Amtrak as a private company, and a private company could not be involved in regulating another private company. So that rule was thrown out. But when that rule was in effect, the passenger trains were running much more reliably. NARP is trying to get that law retained, but take the word the words that involve Amtrak out of it, so that the metrics would be looked after by the Federal Railroad Administration, and we feel that that would give us the same result without the conflict.
Interesting. So they fought to, the freight railroads essentially fought to have the right to delay the passenger trains a little more. We'll talk more with Art Poole, who's with NARP, the National Association of Railroad Passengers, about passenger trains. We have several calls waiting. We'll take your calls and emails when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about passenger trains. The occasion is that it is National Train Day, an Amtrak entity. Coming up on Saturday, there'll be observations, celebrations at the train stations in Dunsmuir, Klamath Falls, and Eugene, many other stations across the country as well. Here's our chance to talk once again about passenger trains, past, present, and what we'd like to see in the future. Our guest is Arthur Poole, a member of the National Association of Railroad Passengers, or NARP. He lives in Coos Bay, Oregon, and has been, until recently, the vice chair of mission accomplishment at NARP. Long history with NARP itself, existing just before Amtrak was created, about 4 years before Amtrak started in 1971. NARP came on the scene to help keep passenger trains viable in the United States, and it's been fighting that fight for a long time now. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 or 541-552-6782 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. Let's take a call from Mark in Reading. Welcome to the Exchange with Art Poole.
Yes, I have two questions. One, how much more efficient would the Coast Starlight be if there were double track between, or double mainline track all the way between Eugene and Sacramento? And my other question is, are not the so-called freight railways actually common carriers and therefore required by law to accept any legal business that's offered to them?
Double tracking and common carriers. Good questions. Thanks for those, Mark. Art?
Well, certainly double track improves the efficiency of a railroad line. The track that runs, you know, to Reading and especially north, to the Cascade Range, is very tortuous and probably would be extremely expensive to double track, you know, all the way. That would be a decision by the private railroad.
Union Pacific, in this case,
Union,
yeah.
Union Pacific.
Yeah, through the Sacramento River Canyon, you're right. It's mighty, mighty windy and twisty.
In terms of freight rail, I think freight railroads are required to haul commodities that can be hauled by the rail mode. So that is something that they are required to do. I think in the case of passenger rail, we need to come up with a mechanism for the cost of increased services that is fair to the taxpayer, fair to the host railroad, but also, you know, fair to the people who are going to be paying that bill. And I'd like to see a third party. It could be a mutually agreed upon planning agency that has the qualifications to analyze a line and the improvements that are required. It may be that double tracking a line entirely would not be required. Perhaps extended sidings would allow for passing freight trains more efficiently. That kind of thing. Let me give you one example of how there can be a public benefit by some of these kinds of improvements. In Oregon, north of Eugene, there's a railroad bridge across the Willamette at Harrisburg that has had a slow order for many, many, many years, 30 miles per hour. And Union Pacific is replacing that bridge right now with a grant from this Connect to Oregon program, which is lottery-backed bonds. But the lion's share of that money for the replacement is coming from Union Pacific. In ballpark figures, I think the bonded part of that is like $4 million, and the Union Pacific part of it is like $16 million, and it will still be single track, but Union Pacific is going to engineer that for speeds up to 79 miles per hour, which is the maximum speed on conventional track for passenger trains. And that will definitely provide a public benefit in terms of improving the Cascade service. I think the reason why it wasn't double-tracked is the approaches to that bridge on either side are quite lengthy and are on fills, and I think that's part of the reason. I don't know all of the details, but
well, that's a good
anyway,
example
that's
you're
going
pointing
on,
out.
And that does show where there can be some cooperation, because Union Pacific, being a large entity, might decide, well, that bridge may be slow, but we can live with it, and we're going to put maybe our capital expenditures elsewhere. But the fact that there was, Oregon was willing to put up some money, kind of entice Union Pacific to make that improvement in Oregon and maybe not in Texas or some other place.
Mm-hmm. So a public-private partnership that worked out for everybody's benefit. Let's go to John in Veneta. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Art Poole from the National Association of Railroad Passengers, NARP.
Good morning. Jeffrey, I just want to thank you and everybody at Jefferson Radio. These great shows day after day.
Oh, thank you.
It can't be easy coming up with all these topics. They're so varied. Art, when I was a young lad, 1963, I went to the Seattle World's Fair, and they had a future train show there, a display. And I can remember some of the techniques, because my heroes have always been inventors. This one train that they had envisioned, the elevator floated on electromagnetism. And I think they incorporated like a multiple stage potential, where they put it in a tube and then they could vacuum it. So it has basically no friction as far as wheels, bearings, and all. And then the vacuum sucks and pulls it through. Okay, now that's a lot to grab at first if a person hasn't already thought about it. But I'm thinking that what could happen is we could have above ground, which I think would be healthier for people's minds, more enjoyable, and a ribbon of the best photo cell technology going along. And they've had some major breakthroughs. And using carbon fibers and all the good stuff, if we skipped a few rockets and bombs, maybe we could just build a really futuristic train. And what I would like to know from you is, what can you tell us about what people are looking down the road, or is anybody bothering?
All right, good question. Thanks for that, John.
Well, yeah, people are looking at concepts similar to what John describes. I think there's a computer expert in California looking at a pneumatic tube-type technology.
A Hyperloop, I think it was called, yeah.
And, of course, Maglev has been looked at pretty seriously in Europe, especially Germany, and in China. And actually, China has one in operation, I think, between Shanghai and the airport. And I was talking to a friend of mine just a few weeks ago who rode that. And interestingly enough, you still get a kind of a clickety-clack sound when you ride that, where there are some, I guess, joints on the guideway.
That's funny, clickety-clack with magnetic levitation.
Yeah, but I think that technology is very expensive to develop. A lot of it's elevated guideway, I think it would be more cost-effective to build high-speed rail, using steel wheel technology, such as is occurring in many parts of the world, Europe and China and Japan.
It's standard railroad technology, the wheels on the rails, yeah,
right.
But just a lot faster. So what's been the holdup thus far? I mean, is it just an unwillingness in American politics to come up with the billions of dollars it takes? I mean, other than California's high-speed rail thing, which, again, was goosed largely with federal money, is it just an unwillingness to come up with the kinds of piles of money that it takes to get high-speed rail into operation?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I think with this whole discussion about high-speed rail with the current administration. I think people realize that it is an expensive investment. I think as far as, you know, you're asking about NARP's goals, NARP does believe that a country like the United States can support at least one true high-speed line, and if we do that successfully, I think it will capture the imagination of people, and it will, you know, foster further development. And California is a good state to do this in because of its high population and the fact that it's still growing. And so it'll be, I think, a success. But these things are very difficult to get launched in a democracy such as the United States. Lots of opportunities to object, and lots of environmental reviews are required. So it's not like in China where they can determine we're going to put in $300 billion worth of investment, and it happens. You know, the United States and other democracies don't operate that way, so it's not as easy to do. There have been some high-performance train improvements in this country, though, that I think will be very successful. A good example of that is what's going on between Chicago and St. Louis. That line is already up to 110 miles per hour in places, and will be a big improvement over when I last rode it a few years ago, where trains had to go into dead-end sidings and then back out onto the main line to pass other trains. And it'll be a much improved line at considerably less expense than true high speed. But I think, with looking at it in a positive way, I think the true high-speed initiative has shown that you can make some improvements to conventional rail. One person mentioned double tracking.
Mm-hmm.
If you improve the engineering of these lines, you can operate more efficiently with more frequent train service and be competitive with the automobile, and in some cases with aviation. After all, we're actually having a tough time hanging on to flights in smaller airports. Klamath Falls,
right, sure.
Lost its air service, and I don't think there's any Greyhound service through Klamath Falls anymore. The Amtrak Coast Starlight does serve Klamath Falls at reasonably good times, but Mark in Reading, his train comes through in the middle of the night, mm-hmm. so not so good. He could use another train that's offset maybe by 12 hours so that it comes through at a more reasonable time mm-hmm. for folks living in that area.
Let's take another call. Here's Donna in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Art Poole from the National Association of Railroad Passengers.
What name did you say?
Donna, you.
Donna? Oh, yes. Oh, too many things to talk about. First of all, I wish they would think big, talk about things, thinking big, use the word investments more, and actually to spend more attention on the real costs of rail and that those sort of priorities about how much does it really cost when you compare it to what we do for other transportation. But also on talk, I'm a fan of rail, and I won't fly. Anyway, I go to Eugene and go to New York, and I like that trip. But it's, of course, getting to Eugene is a big problem, or getting to a connection is a big problem. You always have to have someone drive. But last summer, Amtrak, there was a bad experience from Portland. They put us on a bus 4 hours to Spokane.
Mm-hmm.
And it was it wasn't an Amtrak bus. It was just a plain old bus that wasn't nearly as comfortable, and we didn't stop. And then there's a wait in Spokane, which we can, at least we retired people can put up. But then the train hit a bulldozer in North Dakota with all this fracking energy stuff. The train was really well handled. I was in the dining room. Anyway, that was not the train's fault, but it clipped the bulldozer, made a whole day's delay. But an interesting thing about it was there was so little publicity about this bulldozer driver being killed, and the relationship to all the activities that's going on there.
Sure.
And
Don, I'm sorry to interrupt. We're getting short on time.
Okay.
Do you have a question?
I'll quit. I had to throw some of these things out.
All right. Thanks for that, Don. Appreciate that. Art, I want to finish up with just, you mentioned something about profitability is not possible. You're saying nobody can make money on passenger trains in America?
Well, probably not. Even in the Northeast Corridor, where Amtrak talks about profitability above the rail, that would not be possible without the huge amount of capital expenditure that's been made in, for example, electrifying the line between New Haven and Boston and replacing bridges. And there's still more facilities that need upgrading, some tunnels, for example.
All right, so they could, in other words, they can make some money based on the daily operating cost. When you think about the amount they have to spend for the infrastructure,
different story.
All right, well, we're not going to solve all the problems of passenger trains in this one sitting, but I'm glad we had a chance to air them out. Art Poole is a longtime member of the National Association of Railroad Passengers and a member of a number of other organizations involving transit and rail in the state of Oregon. Art, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
You're very welcome, Jeff.
All right, take care. Tomorrow on the Exchange at 8 o'clock, we'll talk to the folks from the Rogue Hack Lab about what they do. It's about makerspace. We'll talk about race and this time theater with Oregon Shakespeare Festival actors. And then at 9 o'clock, we'll talk to Dr. Wes Crenshaw. He'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange to talk about living with ADD. His book is I Always Want to Be Where I'm Not. That's all tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer is Charlotte Duren. Our student assistant is Reed Newland, operating the controls today. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Please join us again tomorrow at 8 for another edition of the Jefferson Exchange here on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. And have a great day.